Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. I want to remind you as we get this show going that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program, a multidisciplinary care service dedicated to relieving symptoms and improving the quality of life of IBD patients. For more information, the number is 1-800-492-5538. Since 2001, we have had a constant discussion on the air here, building up to what happened in Afghanistan, and especially building up to the war in Iraq, with a series of panelists from all over the globe and all over the country, from varying positions about whether or not we, the United States, should have engaged, should have made war with Iraq. And two of those people who have been with us from the very beginning, Dr. Robert Friedman, who is then president of the Baltimore Hebrew University, now professor emeritus from there, and a visiting professor at Johns Hopkins, and Talbot Abdullah, who is from Iraq, was captured and tortured by Saddam, was teaching in Toronto. He was a professor of history at York University. Unfortunately, Talbot couldn't be here. He was feeling not well. They had to go to the doctor. We'll look forward to having him on right after the holidays. But Dr. Bob Friedman is with us, and we also are joined in the studio by another man who's been on the show many, many times, Dr. Adil Shamu, who's senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus and a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and Phyllis Bennis, who's author of Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Adil, Phyllis, Robert, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
And we are going to take a look at what's going on in Iraq now, what is happening with in the Arab and Islamic world. Since 2001, how that has changed dramatically over the last 10 years, what the United States and the Arab world and how they will interact in the future, we think, as 2012 arrives, and also talk a bit about how what happens between Israel and Palestine affects all of that. So let me just begin by talking about what's happened with the United States troops leaving Iraq. And what that means for American policy there, what it means for Iraq. We've seen the news today, at least the New York Times and Al Jazeera, reporting about the explosions in Iraq, about al-Maliki, who I'm looking forward to hearing about your interactions with him that you had, Adil, when he was in this country, al-Maliki kind of opening the door by attempting to arrest the vice president from the Sunni political party who fled to the Kurdish territory. And the bombs that took place this morning. So let's talk about what we think is happening now and with more than just the argument about, oh, Obama made a mistake, you shouldn't have pulled them out or should have pulled them out. But the question is, what do you think all this portends for this moment? Let me start with Adil.
Well, I think we don't know all the facts yet, but I don't believe the Sunnis and Shiite, this is among the two factions in Iraq. It's not in their interest to get involved in literally killing civilians. All these suicide bombing from the early news we hear were civilian targets. Maybe it's an al-Qaeda where they simply want to disrupt the al-Maliki regime and foment sectarian violence with each other. The groups as a whole, they're talking to each other, despite the fact it's not going well. But they are talking to each other, and I am cautiously optimistic that among themselves will calm down, but al-Qaeda obviously has grown in Iraq, unfortunately.
Bob?
Well, I wish I were that optimistic, but I'm not. I think al-Qaeda may be trying to rebuild the original alliance with the Sunni. And if you look at what Maliki has done, he's really alienated the Sunni. I mean, he's arrested, first of all, several months ago, 600. He now alleges that the vice president, who has fled to Kurdistan, by the way, ran a murder squad. A lot of the stuff is too hard to believe. And on the surface, at least, it looks like Maliki is trying to establish a dictatorship. As of today, you know, what he said was that if the Sunni wish to pull out of the government in protest, they can do it, but it's at their cost. So I'm afraid that things, at least currently, do not look too good for Iraq.
Phyllis Bennis.
I agree that things don't look very good in Iraq, and I think this was something that we knew was going to be the result of the U.S. invasion and occupation that began in 2003. I don't think we can separate what's going on now when the U.S. took over, it put in place a very consciously created sectarian-based governing structure. And this kind of sectarian fighting has gone on with various levels of violence. It hasn't, thank God, always been the kind of violence we saw during 2006 and 2007, when it was at the, when the war itself was at its worst in this heavily sectarian way. But the sectarian fighting for political control and political influence is very much a product of that U.S. decision to impose a sectarian-defined governing structure. And certainly al-Maliki, who was put in place by the U.S., protected by the U.S., paid, armed, and financed by the U.S., has made that worse in the recent period. I do think that the immediate set of violent attacks of today, which probably took quite a bit of time to plan for that level of coordination that we saw, it's unlikely to be linked to the immediate governing crisis that began a few days ago. I don't think there would have been enough time to put that together to respond. But overall, the level of violence is a reflection of the existing, continuing level of the sectarian legacy that the U.S. invasion left in place.
Good, Adil.
There is something else also in our culture, in American culture, especially the media. We expect solutions to these entrenched problems to occur, you know, briefly, within a month or two, a year or two. If we go to our own country here, it took 100 years from 1776, War of Liberation, to civil War in
1864.
1864, right. That's right. Not, did I say 19? Yeah, 1864. So, and still the reverberation of that civil war till today, as a matter of fact, we hear, you know, in politics. So I am, the reason I have sort of cautious optimism, I am not surprised whatsoever that the level of violence, and it may even get worse or go down. Regardless, there's going to be time, years to come, before Iraq really settled. What was not going to settle it is if our footprint has remained as high as it used to be, and even the current footprint, as you know, I wrote an article about it, is the U.S. really leaving? Because we still have almost 20,000 people in Iraq. The lesser the footprint, the more likely, I think, the violence will subside.
Well, go ahead. Was that Phyllis? Was that you or Bob? Bob, go ahead.
Can I jump in here for a minute?
Please go ahead.
Let's remember, it was a sectarian regime under Saddam Hussein. It was an extremely ugly regime that murdered lots of Kurds, that murdered lots of Shia, murdered lots of Sunni. So let's not make what the U.S. did as something horrible compared to what it was before under Saddam. Under Saddam, it was much worse. That's number one. Number two, we didn't put in Maliki. Maliki won in an election. It's one of the first fair and free elections ever in the Arab world. So I don't think it's fair to say that we, the United States, put him in. It's true we supported him, and we hoped that the government would work out well in the end, but I don't think we put him in. It was a fair and probably the first free and fair election in the Arab world in many years.
Because we tried to put Iyad Alawi. That was our favorite one.
Phyllis, go ahead.
I need to respond to the initial point that Bob just made, which I think is very problematic. The regime of Saddam Hussein was a terrible regime. It was a dictatorial regime that, as you say, had killed many, many people. It was a regime that, until the summer of 1990, was backed by the United States. We provided the seed stock for the biological weapons program that Saddam Hussein's regime made. So we bear an enormous responsibility for that regime. We supported Iraq throughout the years of the Iran-Iraq War, not because we supported it particularly, but because it was the weaker power, and the U.S. was very concerned about keeping that war going, which is exactly what we did by supporting the weaker side.
Excuse
it was only
me,
with the invasion of Kuwait in 1990 that was reversed. But the notion that because it was a terrible regime, that somehow that legitimates what we have done directly. The numbers of Iraqis that were killed first by sanctions and then by the war far outstrips the number of Iraqis ever killed by their own government. So I think we need to have some real understanding here of the level of obligation that our country, our government bears for what is facing Iraqis today.
Well, I have to disagree with
Bob
that.
Friedman.
I mean, to claim that we were the ones who supported Saddam the whole time and we wanted to keep the war going, I think simply misreads history. We didn't even reestablish diplomatic relations with Iraq until 1984. Yes,
we were already providing weapons.
Yes, we provided some photo reconnaissance.
Surveillance and weapons.
Wait, one at a time. One at a time. We can't.
You know, I think, of course, Mark, as you know, we fought over on this one for many years. But I think to say that U.S. is the main prop of Saddam Hussein, I think misreads history. And let me leave it at that.
Can I comment on that, Mark?
I do.
It's really worse than what Phyllis Bennett said. As a matter of fact, we brought the Ba'athist Party and Saddam Hussein as its leader. In 64, the general secretary of the Ba'ath Party, he said, we came to power at the U.S. gravy train. That's his own. And there are many reports indicating that we helped topple the nationalist regime, Qasem's regime, because he was not compliant with our demands. So it goes way back. The Ba'athist parties, they were all supported, funded in part, but especially in Iraq, we helped them. As a matter of fact, Nasser of Egypt publicly stated when he had a tiff with the United States, publicly stated, and he released all the document indicating that we helped the Iraqi Ba'athist Party to come to power.
Of course, the Iraqi Ba'athist Party was one of his main enemies, so he had reason to make that argument.
That's correct. Well, they became his enemy when they didn't do the unity with him.
Yes, exactly right. They didn't join the United Arab Republic, as he hoped.
That's correct.
1958. And hence you had an Arab Cold War going on for many years before the Ba'athists took over. So, again.
So. I mean, the arguments about the origins of this are going to be intense and remain. And I think that the question I want to explore now is, where does this go? I mean, I think that if you just take Iraq for a moment, we'll get to these calls coming in at 410-319-8888, Russ, you're the first caller up, is that right now we're seeing in Iraq, let me take a step backwards. When you look at what happened in Yugoslavia for a moment, as an example, the only thing that held those republics together was this powerful government under Tito. The government fell apart. And what was known as Yugoslavia, a creation of the post-World War II era, fell apart into its component parts. What some people are arguing now is what we're seeing in Iraq is with the powerful dictatorship of Saddam Hussein thrown out, that you're going to see the same kind of pulling apart in Iraq.
It's an entirely different history.
Well, they're not completely, history. But go ahead, Phyllis.
It's a different history in the sense that with not exactly the same borders, but generally, the country of Iraq and formerly old Mesopotamia didn't include the Kurds, but included pretty much the rest of current-day Iraq, has a long history with a national consciousness. That wasn't imposed by Saddam Hussein. That existed way before Saddam Hussein came on the picture. So I think that we have to be very careful not to draw analogies between historical examples that are very, very different. These were not different countries. We're talking about an era before states existed. There was no Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait. There were no national lines drawn like that. But one of the few national identities that did exist throughout the Ottoman period and before, going back several millennia, was old Mesopotamia, which was more or less what is the borders of contemporary Iraq. The Kurds, as I say, were not part of that. But this notion that Iraq was an artificial construct held together by the brutality of Saddam Hussein, I think, really begs history.
Except me this question out to all of you, and you can pick up Adil, and then Bob and Phyllis come back in, and then I'll get to the phones. But all that notwithstanding, what you just said, Phyllis, What we're seeing in the 21st century is a different political dynamic, and that for what all the reasons that we can delineate, that people can agree or disagree on, that the Shia and Sunni worlds in much of the Arab Islamic world are at odds for lots of political reasons. And so what we are seeing in Iraq could very well come apart for those reasons. I mean, the same thing is going on right now in Saudi Arabia, where a lot of the Shia populations are feeling oppressed, and in the oil-giving regions, what happened in Bahrain. This is not something that can just easily be dismissed as saying historically that Iraq was just always one people, or Mesopotamians were all one people.
I'm not saying that it was a unified people at all times, that there were no divides. Of course, there were religious divides. There's others. There's ethnic, cultural, linguistic, all kinds of divides. What I am saying is that there was a national consciousness in contemporary Iraq that goes back to the days of ancient Mesopotamia, which was not the case for the former Yugoslavia. I'm simply making that statement. I'm not saying that there are no schisms within Iraqi society or other societies, but I do think that there are political and economic reasons for the schisms to take a violent form and a separationist form that go way beyond simple religious differences.
Yeah, Mark.
Bob Friedman.
Yeah, on this one, actually, I agree with Phyllis. I mean, if you go way back, it was one of the reasons that Faisal was able to really establish himself, with the British help, of course, as king of Iraq, because there was an Iraq. And by the way, traditionally, Mesopotamia also included Kuwait, which is sort of an artificial construct. But that's another situation. The dilemma now, though, is, I think, very serious. I mean, you have the Kurds who, for all intents and purposes, are pushing for more and more autonomy, if not quite independence, making deals with oil companies, now shielding the Sunni vice president, and the Kurds are Sunni, by the way, not Shia. And I think there is a problem, and I think what we're seeing in the Sunni-Shia conflict, which is really rising up as part of Iran against everybody else, may take place also in Iraq, and that is worrisome.
I think Bob has a point, and that is, of course, there are fault lines nowadays, and they were cracked further than their natural fault line by our occupation, let's face it, and by foreign interference from Saudi Arabia, who's pouring literally billions of dollars to get the Sunnis to rise up against the Shiite and manipulating them. So I fully agree, but I think there are other forces, and what Phyllis mentioned, I'll even go further. For 7,000 years, that Iraq had a national sort of cohesion, not the way as a state, and the power for 1,500 years emanated from Baghdad all the time, all the way to North Africa, all the way to India even. So that forces every Iraqi is extremely very proud of, and they wouldn't want to see it just disappear. Now, the Sunnis, and I hate really, because when I lived in Baghdad, we never said Sunni and Shiite. We really didn't.
Which is what every Baghdadi has said to me that I've met.
Yeah, right. They will say Muslims and Christians. I was Christian, so that's the only differences, okay? And the Kurds and Arab. And this is why those false lines, they may not succeed, because there is that kind of drive. But in addition to that, the Sunnis area, now that they sort of live in as a overwhelming majority, they don't have really an economic infrastructure to survive on their own without the rest of Iraq. So that will be a driving force.
So let me just add, and I'm going to open the phones here, because I'm going to talk about some other parts of the Arab and Islamic world, and really curious what you think the U.S. response should be to what's going on, because I think it's it's fascinating to watch, as you wrote about, the Islamist parties as a political force that's going to stay here, whether we're talking about Turkey, Egypt, or Tunisia, or anywhere else. But what do you think? What do you think is? I mean, nobody has a crystal ball, but what do you all think is going to happen, and what should be the U.S. response, if there should be one, even to what is about to unfold in Iraq?
I think it's natural when all secular parties were decimated by the forces, whether it's the occupation or Saddam Hussein or whatever other forces, that religious parties use the house of worship just the way the civil rights movement used the house of worship as a place to gather and for, you know, and promote
analogy.
And promote their well-being. And that's why the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, despite all the oppression of Mubarak towards any other group, he couldn't go every day to the mosque and arrest these people because would have done worse. The recruitment would have been bigger even. And so it's not surprising. And in my article, but I said, why are we surprised that Muslims use Muslim slogans? Just remember, the Republican nominees for president of the United States in 2011 used Christian slogans to promote their welfare. And this is 230 years after the establishment of our country. So why wouldn't these people, they just started in freedom and democracy, they will use those slogans. So I believe moderate Muslims, as they are already majority in Tunisia, in Turkey, and I think they will come into Egypt. And just before the show, I was telling you, the Muslim Brotherhood Party met officially with the Foreign Office of the Cuban Communist Party and the ambassador of Cuba in Cairo. So they are not that kind of people. Oh, I don't want to shake your hand. They are not neurotic. They are as moderate as the Turkish.
So, Phyllis, go ahead then, Bob, and then we'll move on to a new subject for a minute.
I think that the worst possible thing that could happen would be for the U.S. to respond militarily by sending more troops. As Adil mentioned, there's already something between 15 and 16,000 U.S.-paid contractors in Iraq. The difference is they're now paid by the State Department rather than the Pentagon. That's the only – it's one of those distinctions without a difference based on the requirements of the Status of Forces Agreement. But that's bad enough. But if the U.S. decided that in the wake of more violence that we're going to send more troops, all that does is escalate the level of violence. It will not bring stability. It would be the absolute worst outcome from this.
Bob,
Mark,
go ahead. Bob
first
Friedman.
Of all, I don't think we're going to send, we, the United States, are not going to send more troops. One of the achievements of the Obama administration, as the president took full credit for, was getting the troops out of Iraq. So I don't see sending combat troops back into Iraq. We'll be hectoring, as Vice President Biden did today, to Maliki without a lot of effect. So that's the first thing. I don't think we have to worry about that. Now, to what degree the contractors who are there to defend State Department people are the same as Marines in battle dress is a very open question that Phyllis and I can go around another day. But let me make the second point, which deals with the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, and other Islamic groups. I think the U.S. has finally woken up to the fact that it has to negotiate and talk to Muslim groups. And what we're seeing in Morocco, which hasn't been mentioned, but you had, you know, an Islamist victory in the Moroccan That's elections, right. albeit you know, the power of the parliament there is still limited, an Islamic victory in Tunisia, still jockeying between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is more moderate, and the Salafine, who are less moderate, in Egypt, but so far the Muslim Brotherhood seems to indicate that in Parliament it will make a common cause and a coalition, not with the Salafine, the Orthodox Muslims, but with the secular parties, which I think is a very good sign. So none of this requires American troops. What it requires is quality American diplomacy.
And I want to add, the emphasis of these parties now, especially the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, is on nationalist issues rather than religious issues. The length of the skirt and things like that.
Although we should not ignore the attacks on women recently in Egypt, which was not carried out, as far as we know, by the Muslim Brotherhood.
Absolutely not.
They were carried out in the name of Islam, and the role of the military in carrying those out and using the claim that this is somehow representative of the requirements of Islam is a very dangerous development.
I agree with you.
That going to have to really deal with.
I think
and
that's
the attacks and the attacks on Christians, which seems to have been at least in part carried on by the military government.
I think it played in the hand of the military to enforce their power. It's unfortunate and it's very dangerous, and I hope the military will step back.
Now, I want to move into Egypt here for a moment, but I got to take a break, and then in a few minutes, then we'll go to Egypt and our callers and then to Egypt. Because, I mean, we've had on the show in the last 2 weeks, and I've been in touch almost daily with people in Cairo, with many women in Cairo, with many women activists in Cairo, and Jahan Hafiz from Real News, who's been covering this in a very brave manner. It was almost gotten by the troops themselves, having attempted to rip off her clothes and beat her. She got away. And that it very much, almost every woman to a person has said that this is falsely being done in the name of Islam through the power of the military and the junta that's taken over.
Absolutely.
As they put it, and it's very troubling. And I think that I think this is just about the fear of women, who many of whom are in the forefront of this movement.
Absolutely.
And that's a big part. And this is and it's a very frightening scenario.
I agree fully. And the military wants all the time to divide and conquer. Remember, these were the same military thugs which served Mubarak.
Exactly.
There's not yet been a revolution in Egypt. There's a revolutionary process underway. It's not yet a revolution.
That's right.
Right. Mark, what you're saying is, in time after time after time, the military ruling council in Egypt is using one pretext after another to try to maintain its power. And that is the problem. And they will use virtually any pretext to do it, and that's unfortunate. What we're going to see, and after the next parliamentary election third is finished, then we're going to see the forming of a coalition. Then I think it's going to get very interesting, because once parliament comes into power, so to speak, and you have a coalition between the Muslim Brotherhood and a few secular parties, they're going to assert themselves in the drawing up of the new constitution, and the military is going to oppose this. And I think here the United States could be very helpful by trying to urge the Egyptian military, which after all does get quite a bit of money from the United States, to keep its hands off the constitutional writing process.
We're going to take a very brief break.
The chances of that, I'm afraid, are not very great, though. I agree with you. This is the exact role that the U.S. should be playing, given that we're providing $1.3 billion a year to the Egyptian military directly with no civilian oversight. The very least that the U.S. should be doing is to use that money as a lever to force that kind of hands-off position. I don't anticipate that will happen.
We have to take a break. We can come right back to our three guests. You just heard Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, which is director of the New Internationalism Project, Dr. Robert Friedman, professor emeritus at Baltimore Hebrew and visiting professor at the Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Adil Shamu, who is senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. We'll be back, and I promise when we come right back before we hit Egypt and other issues in depth, we'll go to Russ, our first caller up. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are looking at the Arab and Islamic world 10 years after 9/11, how it's changed drastically, where it might be headed, and also the United States' role in these last 10 years and what may or should be our role in the next 10 years and in the future. 410-319-8888 is our number. We're here with Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose book is Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a Primer. Robert Friedman is a visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University, former president of Baltimore Hebrew University. Adil Shamu is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus and a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. 410-319-8888. As I promised, I'll go right to the phones. People have been very patient. And Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Welcome.
You asked a question earlier, where does it go from here? And realistically speaking, I don't think anybody can say, because there's still a bunch of sideline players out there, like Muqtadar al-Sadr. We had the so-called surge a while back, and nothing was decided on the battlefield. It wasn't the increase of troops that made the difference, but we know that the Bush administration put up $300 million to Muqtadar and his militia to stand down, but he simply took his soldiers off the field of play. And additionally, he got about $2 to $3 million in a weapons exchange program. So what do we know? We know that he's there. He has $300 million plus the interest is drawn. He knows that the weapons are in place for him to do whatever he wants to do with his militia. So I think that one of the lessons we may end up learning from this fiasco is that it, what it took, what it takes in Iraq is a homicidal maniac like a Saddam Hussein to hold the factions together and make the country function as dysfunctionally as it did. Thanks, Mark, for letting me vent.
Okay, Russ, good to hear from you as always. And Phyllis, you would like to grab that first?
Well, I think that it's a mistake. I think it does not give any credit to the people of Iraq to say that the only way that the country can function is through dictatorship. I think that it is true that the U.S. has armed a whole range of forces in Iraq, in a huge host of militias, the biggest of which is called the Iraqi National Army, but in many ways is no different than the militia of Muqtadir al-Sadr, except that it's bigger, and it represents its own interests, as they all do. There's a huge problem of lack of coherence in Iraq. But the solution to that is going to have to be an internal Iraqi solution. It's not going to be a solution, if it's going to have any sustainability, it's not going to be imposed either from outside by the U.S. or any other outside power, or by the rise of a new dictatorship. I think, you know, what we've seen in the Arab Spring is that that's really not going to happen in the 21st century. And Iraq is not going to be immune to that. We've already seen aspects of the Arab Spring rising in Iraq. There were protests some months ago that were suppressed quite brutally. They haven't yet re-risen, but I anticipate that they will within coming months or perhaps years. But I think that there has to be some agency for the people of Iraq to make their own judgments. They won't probably be judgments that any of us might choose, any of the kinds of governance that we would choose to live under, but it's not our call, you know? I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't get to say what kind of relationship between mosque and state there should be in Iraq or any other country. So I think we need to back off and say that it's going to be up to the people of Iraq to make that judgment, to make that determination.
Bob, do you want to jump in for that?
Yeah, I'd like to jump in. I think the caller, with all due respect, has sort of oversimplified the situation a bit. I mean, the U.S. clashed directly with Muqtadir al-Sadr in 2004. Maliki himself, a few years later, cracked down on Muqtadir al-Sadr, and then has since made at least a semi alignment with him politically. So I think it's a little too simplistic to just take on faith what the caller said.
Let's go back to the phones, and then we'll move to Egypt, and Tyrone and Leo will come to your calls as well. 410-319-8888. Ernest, welcome.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening. I said welcome, Ernest.
Yeah, okay. One of our heroes and saints, Reverend Martin Luther King, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King, said the United States is the greatest purveyor of terrorists in the world. And you can see this with both wars in Iraq. We have been bombing and killing innocent people in Iraq since the 90s. And then came up with a war, said it's weapons of mass destruction, didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, had all kinds of bombings at night, bombing innocent people, men, women, and children, actually putting them in a furnace. And it's no outcry. It's no hue and cry for the innocent, supposed to be human beings. Now, I wonder if American citizens think that Muslims and Iraqis are human beings. I mean, it's no trial or no nothing. You talk about all the war criminals, everybody going to the Ocampo. What has been done in Iraq and around the Muslim world has been a criminal action against innocent people. I'm not talking about Saddam Hussein. What about all the babies and all the women? You look on television where you see women with no legs in a country like that. How can they make it? No husband. No, nothing. And this has been allowed to go on. And it has not been one indictment from nobody in the world, because the world was in on it. The European world was in on this atrocity. And it's just as bad as what happened in Europe. Stalin and Hitler, those atrocities.
So last time when you called in, Ernest, I want to get back to our guest, but you were calling in saying you think there should be you think there should be investigations to war crimes, is what you said. So that's what you were saying.
In both wars.
Okay,
April Glaspie told Saddam Hussein, because of that problem in Kuwait, that it wasn't an American problem. It was an Arab problem. As soon as he went into Kuwait, because they were stealing all, they came up with and bombed the people back, and they had it like shock and awe on television, like it was a video game.
Well, when you call this, and I promise you we'll jump into this, I'm glad you called back to remind us of this. And Adil, we'll go to Phyllis and Bob.
I'm glad the caller brought the issue, because it's really the heart and soul of my forthcoming book, Equal Worth When Humanity Will Have Peace. The equality of life, and what I have observed, that our media, and rightfully so, they should mention the number of American death, which is 4,500 dead, about 30,000, severely wounded. But there is very little mention, if any, of the Iraqi death. It's only in the past month there has been few, once in a while they mention it. Still, the ratio is 100-1 probably in terms of mentioning, as if the Iraqis are not human. It's really this dehumanization of people who are not with us, our opponent or our enemies. They're really, the Iraqi people were never our enemy. So the number of Iraqi killed at a minimum is 200,000 and about 1 million wounded. How could they not be mentioned? Aren't they human? Don't they have brothers, sisters, grandfathers?
You know, if I could just jump in for a minute, I think the caller is raising a very critical point, actually two points. One is about the actual Iraqi casualties, which go unmentioned. We all remember the Pentagon's famous statements, we don't do body counts. But others do, and we can all also remember back in, even before the war officially began, when it was a war of sanctions, and we had the famous statement by then UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright, shortly before she became Secretary of State, when asked about the number at that point of 500,000 children who had died as a result of the impact of sanctions, without missing a beat, she didn't deny the number, without missing a beat, she said, it's a hard choice, but we think the price is worth it. And I remember wanting to shake her and say, if it was her daughters, she has two daughters, if it was her daughters, would she think the price was worth it?
That was before we even got
to shock and awe and 9 years of war and occupation.
But she apologized
a few days later.
Apologies don't get you very far.
A little bit. First of all, the sanctions in many ways were a joke. Saddam had an oil for food program with the UN. He had a choice of how he wanted to spend that money. Did he want to feed his people with it, or did he want to build huge palaces? He chose to build huge palaces with the money. And if you note very carefully, the sanctions were getting weaker and weaker and weaker just prior to the U.S. invasion.
And more
the Russians
and more people
were pumping stuff in. Stuff was coming in elsewhere. So that's point number one. And I have to challenge the figures of 500,000, some people say 1 million, in terms of casualties. I think that's
absolutely still...
That
was the figure of the Lancet.
The Lancet report has been a report that has been highly criticized.
Highly criticized, but never disproved.
Well,
highly
no.
criticized because people didn't like using all of the analysis, all of the...
Bob and Phyllis, I did not use the... I've read all those reports. I did not use the 500,000 or... I said at a minimum 200,000, and I don't think there is any discussion or argument about that number. And the number of wounded, about 1 million. There is really very little argument. Those are minimum numbers.
The point is that it's hundreds of thousands of people died as the result of a U.S.-imposed policy on the United Nations, and then more died as a result of a U.S.-orchestrated war that was waged in the face of massive global opposition. We should remember what happened on February 15th, 2003, just weeks before the U.S. invasion, when, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, up to 14 million people took to the streets on one day to say the world says no to war. And it was ignored by the Bush administration.
This U.S. imposed on the U.N. is simply not true. If you note all the sanctions, vetoes by the Russians and the Chinese, to say that the U.S. imposed its will on the U.N.
I was
is,
at the
I'm
U.N.
Afraid,
those,
a bit
in those months. I was reporting on it, and it's exactly what happened. I can go through from my book exactly what pressures were brought to bear on which countries. Countries were bribed, which were threatened.
Okay,
China
so
was
you're saying that
with...
the Russians and Chinese were bribed.
Yes.
To go along with that. I find that very difficult to believe.
Well, so let me just jump in.
I can tell you exactly what they got.
But
it was 2 weeks before the vote, and the U.S. diplomats had gone to Beijing and said, name your price. And they said, we want two things. We want diplomatic rehabilitation. This was, of course, in the wake of Tiananmen Square. And we want a resumption of long-term development aid. And the U.S. answer was, no problem. And they immediately announced a new package of World Bank loans. That were the first time since Tiananmen Square that they had been granted.
And what did the Russians get out of this?
Well, just a second, folks. Bob and Phyllis, a second. I'm going to jump in just because I want to kind of move the discussion ahead a little bit here. I want to get back to the phones. A lot of people have called in and want to join this. We've only gotten to two callers so far. When you look at what's going on in Iraq, let me just ask this one question. We'll get to Tyrone, Donald, and Leo, who are dying to get into this conversation. I want to get them in here. You look at Iraq, but you're also looking at what's happening in the Arab Spring across the Islamic world. You're seeing today in Syria, the Syrian army has gone into the towns in northern Syria, killing people, fighting the dissidents from the army because they're talking about bringing in observers from the Arab League. You see the elections that took place in Cairo and the horrid assaults on the Egyptian people and those demonstrations throughout Egypt. The parties against the Muslim Brotherhood winning in Tunisia, forming a government. Things are changing at a rapid pace. Bahrain, doctors being put in jail, the U.S. being silent because that's where we have our large military installation. So I'm curious where this is not going to end come December 31st. It's only going to get more intense. So talk to us, the three of you, very quickly, Adil, Bob, Phyllis, about where you think this is taking, what are the next things that could be happening?
Well, the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening, what has done really has shed the fear of the Arab streets from their corrupt government. And that's a huge, huge, that's one thing. And has restored their dignity. If you remember, a lot of the conservative talking head, they used to say basically the Arabs loves these dictators to push them down and rule them by, you know, fire iron rod, and unfortunately that's not true. But everybody bought it, and the issue of restoring their dignity and loss of fear from their corrupt government is now really widespread in the Arab world, and that's why we have to look at the future of Iraq in context about whether we are going to send troops back into Iraq. And I'm glad to hear Bob thinks that will not happen. And this is where really, in a way, Obama should get a credit for it. And I don't think we will be sending troops. But nevertheless, we should be aware that the Iraqi people will not stand to sending more troops into Iraq. I think they will be rebellious, and there will be maybe even an armed insurrection against our troops this time as compared to the previous time. Remember, Saddam Hussein was a rotten apple. When we invaded, the people did not have heart to defend their system of government for good reason.
Bob, and then to Phyllis, and then we'll go back to the phones.
Well, you know, I have to go back to the words of Chou Enlai, the former prime minister of China, who said in 1954 at a conference in Geneva when he was asked about the 1789 French Revolution, his response was, "It's too soon to tell." And I think, at least in my view, things are going in so many different directions in the Arab world. Tunisia looks like it's the closest to moving to what I would call Western-style democracy. The military's hanging on in Egypt. In both Morocco and Jordan, the kings are making some concessions to the people, but not satisfactory to a number of them. In Yemen, whether Saleh leaves actually or doesn't leave is still up in the air. And Syria is a bloody mess. So when we talk about the Arab Spring, I think we now have to talk about Arab Springs, plural, because they're all moving in different directions. And I think it'll be hard to find commonalities. I think we saw the commonalities at the beginning. Rising prices, as has been mentioned, a look for dignity, unhappiness with corruption, unhappiness with age of dictators are holding on. But once that big burst came and the leaders were either overthrown or under siege, you're seeing different countries moving in different directions. And that's what we have to keep an eye on and not have one policy, but probably tailor different policies for different countries.
Phyllis, and then I will go right to the phones. At least three callers in a row to hear what they have to say. So they have very little chance to speak
briefly,
tonight.
I would just say that I think if we look at this year, the rise of the Arab Spring, and I absolutely agree with Bob, they're very different in how they are emerging, but we are seeing a rising against dictatorships that were thought to be permanent, that were thought because most of them were supported by the United States, with the exception of Syria, of Yemen and Egypt and Tunisia. These were all U.S.-backed dictatorships. I think that what we're seeing in that rising is going to end up being by far the most important development we can look at this year when we look back at 2011. It's going to be the Arab Spring, even more than the final withdrawal of combat troops from Iraq, that becomes the most important thing because, as we know, Iraq is not yet free of U.S. military presence. It's not yet free of war.
It's just been 1 year.
What is new is the rise of the Arab Spring.
I think it's just been 1 year, and we should remember that.
Let me go to the phones here, I promise. Tyrone in Catonsville, you're on the air.
Yeah, first of all, anybody that thinks, or is naive enough to think that we won't send troops back to Iraq in past, they're pretty naive because one thing, us leaving Iraq wasn't purely altruistic. We took all troops out of Iraq because talks devolved about immunity for our troops in Iraq. That's why we took all the troops out of Iraq. They couldn't come to an agreement over whether or not our troops would have immunity from prosecution in Iraqi court. And that's why we took all of our troops out of Iraq. Not because we decided out of the goodness of our heart that we should remove all our troops from Iraq. Secondly, you're also naive to the seductiveness of the protection of American power. It's very seductive, military power, I mean. The protection of military power. We have troops in over 100 countries. We still have troops in Kuwait, okay? We still have bases that are in Kuwait from the first Gulf War, okay? And we got bases in Japan. We have bases in Europe. So don't think we won't project force if necessary or if asked to do so to get our foot, get the camel's head under the tent, so to speak. So, I mean, and that war, I don't know if y'all remember this, but there was a term that used, a preemptive war. Okay? It's illegal. It's illegal. We had no business going over there. We can't police the entire world. And if one of them did buy, I don't care if the Don bought 100 birthday cakes or a million birthday cakes with the freaking oil he got. What right do we have to go and invade this country, kill 200,000 people, and it's okay. Everything's fine. Now we're leaving. Sorry, guys. We ruined your country. Have a nice day. The other thing is,
okay,
you also got to consider the Iranians and the other different players on the sideline, Saudi Arabia, as well. So we still don't know what's going to happen in Iraq, and it's very hard to predict. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tyrone. And one thing Tyrone said, I mean, I think he's right. The biggest reason the troops were pulled out was because they could not come to an agreement with the Maliki government on what to do with the troops. I mean, right to prosecute. That was a big factor.
I have a hard time believing that was really the reason. The overwhelming reason. It was a small factor in pulling out the troops. The reason is, now we have 15,000-16,000 who have immunity anyway. So we were arguing about 3,000 immunity. Come on. Let's get real.
Let's get one more caller in here if we can. Donald, you're on the air.
Doing. Can you hear me, Mark?
You can, Donald. We only have a few minutes left, so go ahead.
It's a very interesting conversation. For one, we have to take a look at, this present administration. When Barack was running, you read any editorial in any newspaper in this country, they had always talked about soft power, hard power. And what we're dealing with right now is no more than the recolonization of these countries, because none of them ever been free, because we have to go back into the colonial history. You got to go back into the history. And one of the gentlemen I've been listening to seems that all he's been trying to do is minimize everything, when we know for a fact that it was slant drilling in Kuwait, the Kuwaitis was doing, and America gave the Iraqis the green light to go in. So the thing is that What we are watching is the height of American imperialism, recolonization of this planet. America is an imperialist power, and right. America is exercising its power right now.
Donald, I appreciate your call as well.
Them and us.
And we only have, like, I think, 4 or 5 minutes left, right? 4 minutes left, but I'd like to hear kind of your thoughts about wrapping this up. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, if you want to go back and refight the Kuwait war, basically the Iraqis went to Kuwait and asked for a loan to help them pay for the cost of the war. The Kuwaitis refused. And the analogy that I like the best is if you go to a bank for a loan and the bankers refuse, you just occupy the bank and get your money. And that's the thing that happened. The slant oil business was, if anything, a minor factor, not the precipitating factor in the war.
So we don't have time for the caller, but I would like to get to some closing thoughts about the moment that we're in. I mean, we don't know where Cairo is going to end up, what's going to happen in Egypt and Cairo. Touch and go. The people we talk to in Cairo don't see necessarily victory coming. Some of them think that it's just going to get a harder military dictatorship who's going to block the Muslim Brotherhood from taking power or another election from taking place.
I think I'm cautiously optimistic.
Now, why are you cautiously optimistic?
Because I think the people have really waken up and they are no longer willing to accept corrupt dictatorial regimes. And yes, there will be many, many difficulties, and it's going to take years after years to achieve the full-blown revolution in these countries. But we are moving in the right direction. That's really what's important. I think Egypt military may not be in power within another year.
I would agree with Adil on the first part. I'm not so sure about 1 year to get rid of the military. As long as they can rely on billions from the United States, they're going to be in power. But I do think that the question of the rising of people, this end to a willingness to accept dictatorship, the fear of what comes next, no longer is preventing motion forward. So I think that this is a huge victory. It is not a complete victory. There will be setbacks. There will not be victory in all of the countries where the first steps have been taken. But I think that we have not seen this kind of a rising in the Middle East in 20 years.
Bob?
Yeah, I'm also cautiously optimistic here. I think we've seen good progress in Tunisia. We've seen good progress in Morocco. I'd like to see more progress in Jordan than what we've seen so far. I'm hopeful that with the ouster of Bashar Assad in Syria, you'll begin to move toward democracy in that country. So I think we're moving in the right direction, but it's going to be forward and back, two steps forward, one step back. And I think it's a lot of watchful waiting on the part of the United States while encouraging democracy is what we should be doing.
We didn't even touch Israel and Palestine, the role it plays in all this, but we'll do that on our next show after the first of the year when we'll come back to this. And I want to thank our guest. You just heard Bob Friedman. I want to thank Phyllis Bennis from the Institute of Policy Studies, Adil Shamu. Good to have the three of you in the air. Thank you so much for taking your time with our guests, with our listeners, and bringing your thoughts to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all. We're going to take a brief break and come right back when we are going to switch gears and have two of the folks who have been on here many times, especially during our holiday specials, Leah Gilmore and Edward Polachuk, for a really interesting hour of a little time to talk some Christmas music, song, food, life before we hit the holiday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.